Today's topic is helping our children deal with their fears. One of my favorite quotes on the subject is that worry is like a rocking chair. It can give you something to do, but it won't get you anywhere. And that's from Linda Dilla's book, Calm My Anxious Heart. If you have never read that, that's a really good one. So our speaker today who's going to address this topic is Beth Hemsworth, and it's a real honor to have her with us. You know, the parable that Jesus told in the Bible about the giving out some people one talent and five talents and 10 talents? Well, Beth is clearly a 10-talent woman, and she uses all of them for God. She's a mother of 2 grown children. She's now moved into the grandmother ministry, which is awesome. She was a missionary to Brazil for many years. She runs an art studio, and she does these beautiful glass mosaics. If you've never seen her work, it's absolutely beautiful. She owns and runs a catering company. She's a nurse. She does educational programs for moms, young moms in Uganda. And she has also taught many parenting classes here at Xenos. If you ever want to check out some of the classes, you can get them at the study center. You can check out some of the CDs. Her class is called Building a New Generation. So we are honored to have her as a resource this morning for this topic. So clearly she has not been sitting in a rocking chair, letting her fears hold her back. So let me pray and we'll get started. God, you tell us in your word to be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and petition to bring our request to you, and that you will promise that your peace that passes all understanding will guard our hearts and our minds in Christ Jesus. And I just pray that this morning you will give us a fuller understanding of this verse, and that you will speak to Beth through Beth to us on this topic. And I just want to specifically pray for anyone here that's struggling with fear themselves, maybe even paralyzed with fear, that you will give them some relief this morning and you will direct them to your ways of dealing with fear. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. Well, good morning. It's good to see you all, and I appreciate that you're getting up in the morning and dragging your kids all the way out here to come and talk to us. I hope that we can have a good conversation. So there is a microphone, so when I ask a lot of questions and you want to contribute to the conversation, please just put up your hand and we'll give you the mic. This topic for me is a really interesting one. I kind of have wrestled with it over the last couple months. What do I want to say about this? Because I feel like a great deal of my life has been driven by fear. I grew up as a very, very fearful child. I had a very unsafe home environment with some alcoholism and mental illness going on. And I went into childhood and life as a preteen and life as a teenager full of many kinds of fears. And of course, if you're fearful in one area, it tends to kind of spread out into other areas of your life. So as we go through this, maybe I'll describe a few of those, but I think that we can all relate to the fact that however we grew up and whatever life situation we are in now, life is scary. And we have a lot of fears, and it's natural that our children have a lot of fears as well. So let's think today. We're going to look at the issue of how fears either help us or hold us back, because fear can be a useful thing. We're going to look at some developmental stages and how our fears are different from one time of life to another. And then after that, we're going to look at a little bit about how we as parents can help our children move through those phases and deal with some of their own fears. And so like I said, I'm a person who has dealt with a lot of fear in my life. Fear socially, fear, we took our little children 1,000 miles up the Amazon to live for years. There was a lot of fear involved in that. There's a lot of fear for me. I have a lot of social fears. I just, you know, we all have them. But we don't need to be limited by them. And one of the if you go away with no other thing, go away saying, I listened to a fearful person today who has discovered that there are resources. And there are resources that are so deep and so strong that our lives do not need to be run by fear. And that whatever our fear is, there's a way to get over it. There's a way to move past it. And even if it still follows us around, because we'll hear its footsteps following us behind us, even if it still follows us around, there is a way to live beyond it. So we're talking about fear today. The first question I want to ask is, you know, we look at our kids. I like to use Zach and Zoe because I think they're cute names as our prototype children when they are adults. What will they be like? Are they going to be fearful kinds of people, or are they going to be courageous people? And I think that in my own life, one of the reasons why I have always valued courage really in a very high regard. It's because I had been a very fearful person. When I was 13, I decided I was going to learn how to ride a horse because I was terrified of large animals. And after I'd fallen off a half a dozen times, I realized that they weren't going to kill me, and I got over that fear. You know, but one of the things I wanted so much as a parent was to teach my kids about courage. And I think that we all hope for our kids to be courageous. And so looking at and dealing with our fears is a big part of how that's going to happen. We know that as we help them face their fears today, we are teaching them how to respond to fear in general in the future. So the more we help them to understand what their resources are today, the more able to deal with fear they'll be when they get older. Now, I don't know about you, but I went into parenting feeling pretty inadequate. I thought, you know, I wouldn't know how to make my kids feel loved. I wouldn't know how to take care of them. I mean, I was an ICU nurse, so if they were home on a ventilator, I was okay. But dealing with, you know, all of their needs on the emotional level was really overwhelming to me. And so I want to tell you something that's really, really important about you and your child. You have what your child needs. You do have what your child needs because you are what your child needs. God gave you this child for a purpose, and he gave you this particular child because he wanted you to be that child's parent. And so, you know, that's something that we can rest on. When we're not really sure and we think maybe somebody else could do a better job with our child, back up a little bit and say, wait a minute, I have what my child needs because I am what my child needs. And yes, do-overs would be nice. There are specific days that I can look back in my parenting experience and say, darn, I wish I could have done that over. I wish I could have done that differently. I wish I could go back and kind of erase, you know, oh, I didn't really say that. I meant to say this, you know, whatever. But all of us will make mistakes, and yet we are what our children need. So today we're going to talk about fear. And the first question I have for you is this. How do fears protect us? Because fear is not an inherently bad thing. Anybody? How do fears protect us?
They alert us to danger.
They alert us to danger. Okay. Anything else? I'm going to have to get warmed up here this morning. They alert us to danger. They kind of help us to evaluate situations. They have fear. You know, if we didn't have fear, you know, we'd walk off of cliffs. We would do all kinds of crazy things. We need fear. We need to know what the physical boundaries of the world that we live in are. So fear, it can be a very helpful thing. How do fears limit us as people? How do our fears limit us in our life? Yeah?
It keeps us from trying new things.
Yeah, we're afraid to try new things. Why are we afraid to try new things? I think with this many people, it might be hard to get the mic out, so just scream. Why are we afraid to try new things? We might fail. Yeah, fear of failure is a huge, huge thing in us. And what is it about failure that is so terrifying? Why is it bad to fail? We look bad. The shame that we experience, you know, the hot red face when we do something wrong or we fail or we tried something and we were shown up as being incapable of getting something done or incapable of doing something, it keeps us from a lot of opportunities because we're afraid to try and afraid to fail. How do fears cause damage in our lives? Can fears actually be damaging to us?
It can be paralyzing.
Okay. So how does that cause a problem for us? Louder, please. You can't move forward and take a next step. It can significantly damage our relationships. What about if I'm in a relationship with somebody and I'm so afraid of what they think about me that everything I do is done just to please them? It's going to damage my relationship. It's going to damage me as a person. So fears, you know, can cause us to live a very truncated and isolated life. They can drive friends away from us because we're so worried about what they think of us. It can cause us to lose a job. So fear is a sort of a two-edged sword. We need it, and it can be a problem for us. It's a lot like pain. We need pain. If we didn't have pain, we wouldn't know, you know, what not to touch and what not to do. So we need it. But fear is a reality of life, and We need to think about what we fear and why do we fear it. And we're not going to go into this in great depth right now, but each one of us has a lot of fears. And it's helpful to, as an exercise, to kind of think about, maybe write it down. What kinds of things am I afraid of? And why am I afraid of those things? What is it about those things that causes me to want to pull back or causes me fear? And so I think it's good to look at that, because our children are now developing habits about how they deal with fear, and those habits will go with them throughout their lives unless we can help them to form new habits. So we're going to look at fear through the lens of developmental stages. Now, we all have kids of different ages, and I want to look at this in this way because one thing that's important for us to come away from is the idea is that fear is normal, and fear doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong. Sometimes we can be very, very fearful, and we're really not in any danger at all. And so we see this a lot with children as well. The first stage, and I'm taking this from Eric Erickson's developmental psychology. I studied this in child development back in college decades and decades ago. And these ideas have always stuck in my head because I think that there's such an interesting way of looking at how we move through life. The first 0 to 1 year, the challenge that a child has is to work out for themselves trust versus mistrust. And in this stage, primarily infants are trusting in their caregivers. The key issue that this infant is dealing with on a very unconscious level is my world safe? You know, and how is it that caregivers can influence that belief, is my world safe, is my world not safe? Hugging, giving physical reassurance, that's one way that we can make our kids feel safe. What other issues are involved here? When they cry, they know that somebody is there for them, okay? Giving them physical boundaries. Now, I would think that physical boundaries would make me feel kind of like, you know, you're hemming me in. How does physical boundaries make me feel safe?
Can't go play in the street,
okay. Yeah, well, and even here, we're talking about 0 to 1 year olds, but nonetheless, they need physical boundaries too. And you notice a lot of times they, you know, when they're crying and crying and crying, and you wrap them up in that tight, what do you call those things? Swaddle? Yeah. Makes a big difference. They feel comfortable again. So they need to know, is my world safe? And I want to ask you a question. When a child is crying and crying and crying, does it mean that she feels unsafe? Probably not. And it's helpful for us to kind of take that out of our thinking. Our child is crying because our child is a baby. And that's part of what babies are supposed to do. It builds their lungs, they just do it. It's part of what babies do. And a lot of times there's no particular reason for it. But it doesn't mean that they're afraid. And so sometimes we worry about leaving our child, you know, when they're, you know, really young, maybe in a nursery or something like that. But their crying doesn't necessarily mean that they're afraid. They're just experiencing something new, and they're just crying because that's what babies do. 1 to 3 years old, the challenge for a child is to learn to develop a certain sense of autonomy versus the shameful doubt, oh, I can't do anything. And that's why toddlers just love to get into everything. And their key question in their minds is, can I make things happen? If I push on this table enough, can I make it fall over? You know, if I try hard enough, can I climb up this bookshelf? Children need to explore, and they need that sense of autonomy, that feeling that I can do things, I can accomplish things. One day, I had left a sewing machine on my dining room table, and my son was wanting to accomplish something, so he got up on a chair, got up on the table, got up on the sewing machine, was standing on top of the sewing machine and grasping the chandelier. And I thought, wow, you know, there's an accomplishment. Okay? Sometimes their accomplishments are better than others, you know, or more useful than others. But it was an important thing, you know? And so here, they're learning, I can do things on my own. I don't need to hold mama's hand to make everything happen. And in this stage of life, what kinds of things are children often fearful of in the 1 to 3 years of age? They want to be independent from us, and yet they're not. What is the question? Being left behind. This is one of the biggest fears. Has anyone ever seen a 3-year-old child in a supermarket who has lost sight of their mother or father? It's terrifying. You know, and they're very, very afraid. Being left behind because they want to run away. But they want to be able to look back and make sure you're still there. And so there is that type of fear. And their fear now is based on their own initiatives and the bigger world. Babies are primarily dependent on and reference their caregiver. As 1 to 3 year olds, they begin to reference themselves. Who am I? And I want to take initiative. And so they fear very much being left behind, even though they're running ahead. They need to feel that they're in control to some extent in their life. And that's why they oftentimes will say, me do it. I'm sure we've all heard our children say things like that. What about 3 to 6 years old? This is a wonderful age, and they are learning initiative versus guilt. And what this is about is that they're becoming assertive, and they're pushing their own will. This is when whining starts. Anybody dealing with whining? It's a fascinating phase. But the key issue here is, does what I do matter, and is what I do good? And these are things that kids are asking themselves unconsciously as they go through their life. And they're learning to take initiative. Like this one little girl in the picture is helping. And helping creates a huge sense of self awareness and a sense of belonging when you can help out. And another little girl is dealing with whether or not what she did was good, perhaps. In that picture there where she's looking a little sad. But they want to know, is what I do good? Am I approved of? Is a big issue at that age. And someone talked about boundaries a little while ago. There was a fascinating study done in the 70s about a schoolyard and about boundaries for children. And they made a new schoolyard, a new playground, and it had all kinds of cool equipment and all that. And they let the kids go out, and they did not tell the children how far out into this big field schoolyard they were allowed to go. And so they noticed that all the children clustered around the playground. They clustered around the slide, they clustered around the monkey bars and all that kind of stuff that you were allowed to have back then before it had to be fall proof and all that. But they stayed really close to the walls of the school and close to the playground equipment. And then, after they had let the children get used to that, and they had done this for, probably a couple weeks, over the weekend, they put in a big fence. And they showed they put the fence out, like 50 feet out from the school. And then they let the kids out into the playground. What did the kids do? They ran right up to that fence. Why? When they had been staying, within 20 feet of the schoolyard this whole time, why did they suddenly feel okay to run that far away? Because they were safe. The fence was there. They weren't going to get lost. They knew what their boundaries were. And children at this age need to know, what can I do? What can I get away with? What can I not get away with? And they feel so much more safe, and they have significantly less fear when they know how far they can go. So the kids who were huddling around the playground before, we might say, oh, they're free and unfettered. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Well, what did they do? They clumped together. But when they had that secure fence around them, they went right up to the edges of it. Maybe they even tried to climb over. I don't know. But this is an important thing in this age. They need to know that I can move out and I can do things, and yet they still need a lot of boundaries. And this is the age at which you first start to see in children a fear of failure. A two-year-old doesn't care whether he did something right. He just wants to do it. But when you get into the 3 to 6 year old age, you start seeing fear of failure. Can anybody think of an example of that or something that they've seen, fear of failure? Yes?
My daughter won't want, she won't try. It took a long time for her to write her letters.
Okay.
And I know she can spell her name. She's 4.
Yeah.
It took a while for her. Now, it's like if she, we asked her to draw a stick person, which I know she can do it, she doesn't want to do it because she thinks she's not going to do it quite right.
That is fascinating. This is a very good example. A child who knows how to write their name, who knows how to draw things, but when you ask them to write or to draw or to recite something, they don't want to do it because they're afraid that it might come out wrong. Somebody might think it doesn't look right and that kind of thing. And here's where we first start seeing fear of failure. So we're going to talk today not just about fear of things that go bump in the night, but the other kinds of fears that children have in their hearts about life and failure. Another thing that they learn in this age group is that my words have impact. And this is a powerful thing in a child's life. From 3 to 6 years old, they're learning to talk a lot, and they're learning that their words are impactful. Now, they can be impactful for good, and they can be impactful for harm, but they're learning to wield the power of words. This is the age at which you will start hearing things like, you don't love me, or you don't love me as much as you love my brother or my sister or that kind of thing. And they're experimenting with that power. But with power comes a certain amount of fear, too, because I'm afraid that if I say the wrong thing, then I can drive people away from me. They begin to see that their words have impact. And so this is an age at which social anxiety also begins to come into play, because they see that if they don't say the right thing or if they say something wrong, it can have an impact on people. In the 6 to 12-year-old age, this stage is called industry versus inferiority. Can I accomplish? Am I going to be good at something? Or am I always going to be inferior to the other people around me? The key issues are, can I learn what I need to know? And where do I stand in the crowd? If anybody has a 10, 11, or 12-year-old child, especially a girl, this is a huge issue. And this is a time at which, you know, kids are cruel to each other, because they are working that out. This is a normal developmental stage where they're working out who is best, who's better than the others, who's not as good as the others. And I can't say that it's a good thing necessarily, but it is a normal and natural part of life. And for our kids to be afraid of going to a party, afraid of going to school, and that kind of thing is normal, because they're in that phase where they haven't figured out yet who they are or where they are in this. So fear of rejection, fear of embarrassment. Can anybody still remember being embarrassed in third or fourth or fifth grade? An incident of being about, yeah, I see hands. I used to have a long braid when I was little, longer than this one. And my mother it would take a long time to comb it all out. And one day my mother forgot to comb my hair before I went to school. So I went to school, and I took off my coat, and I hung it up, and I went, you know, went to mix with the other kids, and everybody started laughing at me, because it was obvious that, you know, I had bedhead, you know, and my hair hadn't been done, and my braid was all a mess, and hairs were sticking out everywhere. And being the fearful child that I was anyway, I remember it as just being a horrible experience, and running home from school at lunch to have my hair all braided up again before I went back to school in the afternoon. Is that a ridiculous thing to remember 50 years later? Yeah. But we do, because these things have impact. And this is the an age in which we, all these little slights and all these little bumps are really significant to us. We also, in this age, children start being afraid of their bodies changing. You know, start being afraid, oh, I'm going to be a teenager pretty soon. You know, what does that mean? And there's so much teaching at Girl Scouts and at church and at school and at youth group and at whatever about the dangers of becoming a teenager. I remember one of my children used to cry every once in a while and say, I don't want to be a teenager, you know, because, you know, it seemed like a pretty scary prospect. But fear can be a wonderful thing at this age. Fear can be our ally at this age in marvelous ways. I was fortunate enough that my mother saw that I was a very fearful child and a very unsociable child, and she didn't like that. So her idea that to fix me was to become a Girl Scout leader and send me to camp all the time. And I learned how to fall down hills, and I learned how to you know get into the deep end of the water and be scared. I learned how to be in a tent when a hurricane went by, or a tornado went by a couple miles away, and, you know, and spent the night holding the tent poles down. I learned how to ride a horse and go on a trip where we didn't take tents because we couldn't pack it all on the horses, and it was going to be a great night, and instead we had a thunderstorm all night long. And there were fears involved in these things, but they were wonderful fears, and I loved it. And fear at this age can be exhilarating. So it's wonderful to put our children in a position where they're going to be physically afraid of physical things, like storms and horses and dogs and whatever. Because what usually happens to a child in a storm, 99.9% of the times when the storm is over, the child is still alive. You know? Very, very few people die in storms. Very, 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 very few people die in tents overnight. Very, very, very few people fall off of horses and get really all that badly hurt. And so when we expose our children to these real elemental dangers and they survive, what does it produce in their hearts? Courage. I can do this. I just had a terrifying experience, and I can't wait to do it again. You know, so I got into whitewater rafting as a young adult, spelunking in caves. You know, all that fearfulness of childhood on a physical level got peeled away because of the excitement of fear. And so don't let us think that fear is, I don't want to go because I'm afraid. Who cares? Let's go anyway. It's a wonderful age to be physically afraid in a relatively safe framework. All right. So it's a great painful experience. I will never forget sitting on a road by myself where in an area that's now built up, but at the time was way out in the country, picking the gravel out of my knee so that I could get back on my bike and ride it back home again. Exhilaratingly painful. You know, here I am all by myself out in the country, and I'm picking the gravel out of my knee, and I fell down, and I'm okay, and I'm going to get up and go do it again. All right. Fear can be a very cool thing. How about 12 to 18? Ooh, this is a rough age for fears because they are primarily existential fears. What kind of a person am I anyway? This is a big deal. This is when our kids want to take temperament tests. This is when they buy 17 magazine or whatever and they take all the little tests in there about what kind of a person am I. They want to know that. They want to know what's my temperament. They want to know where do I stand in class. They want to know, am I a student? Am I a jock? Am I a nerd? Am I a this? Am I a that? Am I a goth? You know, and they need some labels. They need to know where they stand with other people. It's an important area or time because one of the things that kids at this time begin to feel is they begin to fear being insignificant. What does that mean? They begin to fear being insignificant. I feared that for some reason because I was a melancholy child many years before this stage. But definitely by this stage, they're thinking, what is my life going to be about? Anybody ever fear being insignificant? Does anybody relate to that? Any thoughts about it? Scream it out.
I don't know. I guess I don't have anything to say about it. I definitely feared being insignificant.
You can relate to that sense. What did it feel like to feel like you might be insignificant?
Oh, terrible.
Terrifying.
Yeah,
terrible.
Terrifying. Yeah.
Can you figure? Was there any thought attached to that?
I also had like a big fear of failure, so I wouldn't take risks. So it was, you know, kind of difficult to feel like you had any significance when, you know, you weren't willing to take risks and stuff like that.
Right.
So I would compare myself a lot to other people that I thought were significant and would find out that, you know, I'm not as good as they are at certain things or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So we're comparing ourselves. At 12 to 18, as a teenager, we're constantly comparing ourselves to other people. And we want to know if we're going to be good as them. And we want to know if we're ever going to be good at anything. You know, and this is a time when everybody's going to ask you, what are you going to do when you grow up? And, you know, and that blank, I don't know, is a kind of a scary thing to have in our hearts. I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up. I don't know. And also another thing that they're trying to decide is, what is important? You know, is there anything I would be willing to sacrifice for? You know, and a lot of teenagers are not that self-reflective, but it's in there, and we need to talk with them and kind of help them and draw that out. Is there anything that's really important in life? Is there something that you really think that you want to be able to do? We also know that fear is exhilarating at this age because of the popularity of horror movies. Kids love to go and get scared at horror movies. Why do they like that so much? Anybody have an idea? Why do kids like scary movies? Any ideas? Why do kids like scary movies? Because it's fake, exactly. Because they can experience, they can see and feel all those feelings that they already have churning around inside of them. And they can see it on a screen, and they can scream, and they can react, and it's not real. They can walk away from it having felt those feelings and know that it's not real. So fear is exhilarating to them and yet difficult. What is the primary question that a teenager will always be asking their parents over and over and over again in a thousand different ways, very covertly and rarely in actual words? What does a teenager want to know? Do you love me? The three main questions on a teenager's mind are, do you love me? Do you love me? And do you love me? These are huge, and they have a lot to do with, I'm going the wrong way. They have a lot to do with this whole issue of what kind of a person am I? Am I good enough? And our kids will be asking that in many, many different ways. So we need to kind of like prepare ahead of time. And I will say one thing, telling them, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, does not answer the question. And now, isn't that an odd paradox? Why does that not answer the question? They have to what? They have different love languages. They need to feel loved. Yeah, just telling them, I love you, I love you, I love you, is really kind of pointless. In fact, it can actually make them feel insecure. I know someone whose mother was worried about her in this age frame, that she might not be popular enough at school, or that perhaps the child was saying she didn't feel popular at school. So every day before the child left for school, and she was about 13, 14, she would say to you are the most beautiful girl in the school. And after a while, she started to feel like, what's wrong with me? Because she knew she wasn't the most beautiful girl in the school. So she started thinking, I must be really ugly if my mother has to keep telling me that. You know? It's true. So, you know, do you love me is important in this stage, especially. Now, then we have to think about love in a whole different kind of way. Am I able to be loved by someone else? Am I able to be valued as a friend and valued romantically? So in the 18 to 30-year-old, it's intimacy versus isolation. And we get involved in relationships, and we make friends, and we have boyfriends and girlfriends and whatever types of relationships that we develop, mentoring relationships, all kinds of relationships. But they hurt. They don't fulfill us the way we want them to fulfill us. And so we have to make choices during this developmental age. Am I going to go with my fear of being rejected or the pain of being rejected and live a life that's isolated and pulled back and be self-protective? Or am I able to keep moving towards people? And this is a big fear issue. And this is the issue, you know, the area where most of us in this room have just come out of that. And now we have hopefully resolved a lot of our questions along these lines, and yet they will continue in relationships as we move forward as well. But here the big question. We begin to make lifelong habits of either moving towards people or isolating ourselves. In adulthood, the 30 and on up into adulthood, we have agency versus stagnation. Agency means... the word agency is a term that's used in philosophy that basically means I, as a human being, make a difference. I am able to have an impact. I'm able to get involved in things, and I'm able to produce things. And agency is something that we all crave to have. And we're wrestling with that now in the 30 to adulthood. Am I a productive person, a person who's making a contribution? Am I doing things that are really useful? Or am I stagnating? Am I just kind of getting by? And one of the things that I think that is a significant issue for a lot of women in this stage, in the 25, 30 to 45, 50 age range, what is one of the things we're most afraid of? What are we most afraid of? And even guys have this fear. What are we afraid of when in this age group, the you know, 25, 30, 35, 40, yes? We're afraid we're not going to be a good parent. I would say that fear was more on my mind than any other fear during that whole phase of my life and drove a lot of my behavior to try to read and study and talk and do things to try to be a good parent. So I want to say, you know, our fear as parents really impact our response to our children's fears. Because if my child is screaming and afraid, what does that say about me? If my child is having nightmares at night and I can't get him to sleep, what does that say about me? Have I provided a safe environment? Have I done things right? Have I, you know, we are full of our own fears. And so now we're at a point where our child's level of development is impacting with our level of development and causing us to question ourselves, because the fears that our children experience in a very subtle way, oftentimes they reflect back on us. They may make us feel embarrassed. Why is my child crying and none of the other kids are crying? They may make us feel overprotective. Oh, no, oh, no. You know, there must be something wrong if my child is crying. Or they may make us develop a relationship that is enmeshed with our children. Now, what do I mean by enmeshed with our children? What's enmeshed? Any ideas? Exactly. Our sense of well-being is dependent on their sense of well-being. We get over-connected with our kids. If they have a bad day at school, we have a bad day. If they're in a bad mood, we're in a bad mood. Everything they do affects us, and it is not healthy to want to be our kid's friend and sit with them and be like totally into every nuance and every feeling that they have. They need someone who stands outside of their teenage experience or their childhood experience who can give them reassurance. Not that we don't get involved, you know, in significant conversation with them, but we're not pulled into everything that they do, and we're not texting them and being texted all day long while they're at school. All right, so what do I contribute and what will I pass on? I do also want to say to those of you who are now taking care of really young children, who's taking care of really young kids? Most of the people here. Okay. Does it kind of feel like your life is on hold? Did most of you go to college? Did most of you have dreams of, you know, being able to do something significant with your life? And now you feel like things are just like not quite, you know, you're not really able to do what you thought you were going to be able to do? I want to say a word of encouragement to you. And that is that it is a very common thing to feel disillusioned at this point in life. You know, I thought I was going to accomplish great things, but here I am, you know, running after little kids and doing this routine, and what am I really getting done in life? But fear not. Just be available and be bold, and God will find plenty of opportunities for you to do very significant things. I want to say that every phase of life has immense possibilities, and every phase of life passes. I myself am on my third career right now. I was a critical care nurse, I was a missionary in South America, and now I'm an artist. And yet there are common threads through all of that, you know, a commitment to discipleship, a commitment to education, a commitment to my friends and my family and so on. But, you know, maybe I'll have a fourth career. I don't know. But we are not limited by the moment we're in today. And so if you're fearful that that everything about you is bound up in being a parent, don't worry, because your kids are going to grow up and you'll have a whole new opportunity to reinvent yourself in a few years. Late adulthood, integrity versus despair. The older adult is looking at their life and they're looking back and saying, did I do enough? Did I do okay? You know, did I live life well? My mother is in this stage. And she, every time I go over and see her, she goes, oh, I'm just so lazy. I'm just so lazy. I'm just so lazy. And I'm telling her, Mom, you're 86 years old. You clean up your house and have your Bible study group every week. Twice a week, as a matter of fact, since you started another one. You know, you do this, you do this, you do this. Okay, you don't crank it out like you used to, but you are not lazy. But why does she say that to me every time I come over? Because she needs reassurance. She wants to know, am I living my life well? She's facing a loss of control. She knows that she's not going to be able to do anything well, you know, in a few more years. And so we're always testing. We always have fears. Anyway, so developmental stages as a means of understanding fear help us to understand that fear is normal, fear is a part of everybody's experience, and fear does not necessarily mean that there's anything wrong. When we have fears or our children have fears, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything wrong. And we can help our children with fears of each stage of life as they come along, but we need to have dealt with our own fears from those stages. You know, we need to think about, what am I still afraid of? You know, and be in prayer about that, and find some help with friends and peers and spiritual mentors, and find out, how can I deal with the fears that I still have? What might be some examples of unresolved fears? Any unresolved fears from developmental phases? Yes?
Out, and I think that was one of my fears growing up, was being left out of the group.
I would say that probably the most common unresolved fear in adulthood is the fear from that 12 to 18-year-old stage of not being socially accepted, the fear of failure and the fear of being rejected. And we still have those ourselves. And so it's really important to us to resolve those fears in our own lives so that we can speak to our children in a way that really gives them encouragement in their life. Okay, that's a really good one. And that's very similar to what I was thinking of. I was so anxious as a child at school. I almost flunked first, second, and third grade. My school told my parents to get me a psychiatric consult and send me to a school for the learning disabled. I wasn't stupid, but I was emotionally overwhelmed by my home life. And so in school, I literally could not hear the teacher talk. You know, I would like be looking at her, and she'd be saying things, and I couldn't understand what she wanted me to do. And so as an older child, that anxiety, you know, diminished significantly. And yet I can remember as a teenager being like maybe 17, 18 years old, walking into a room where all, you know, at the fish house where like these, you know, 50 kids are all sitting on chairs and sitting on the floor and everywhere. And I would walk into the room with such a level of social anxiety that I couldn't recognize anyone. So I'd look around and I'd say, who do I know that I can sit with? And I couldn't recognize. So I would just walk in the middle of it and just sit down. And it would take me a good 15 or 20 minutes before my heart would stop beating. And I could look around and say, oh, hi, you know, or, oh, I know you, or, oh, I sat in the wrong place, or whatever. But that level of social anxiety, you know, through each developmental phase, it can become less. But even today, I hate going to parties. You know, with parties of, you know, big groups of people where I'm not going to know anybody. You know, so these things that we experience, they linger, and yet they don't have to control our lives. You know, we can learn ways to overcome the anxiety that we have. So we do have unresolved fears in our own lives. I was listening to NPR the other day, and it was hysterical. They had somebody who had written a book about the 1,000 things I'm afraid of or whatever, and they had people calling in and with all of their obsessive fears, and they were afraid of things like tape. The stickiness of tape touching their skin, you know, and yeah, it was just all kinds of really crazy things. And of course, we have those as well. But some of our deeper fears, it's very worthwhile for us to take those out and look at them and say, why am I so afraid? You know, and what resources do I have to face those fears? Okay, every day our kids are learning about fear, and they're learning to move forward. And I want to just say that there is not it's not the case either that my child is fearful or that my child is confident. There's a huge space in between there. There's a continuum. And they're constantly moving back and forth. And I don't know about you guys, but as you see your kids develop, you'll often see them kind of leapfrogging each other. One of them is all confident, moving ahead, and everything's going great, you know, and then they kind of stall out developmentally, you know, or they develop fears. And the other one kind of leapfrogs ahead, and that one's the more mature one, and blah, blah, blah. And they go back and forth like that over time. It's not a stagnant thing. But we do need to look at ourselves a little bit and say, what am I afraid of? Because our chronic fears will drive our behavior and drive what we teach our children. Are my fears realistic? What is it exactly that I'm afraid of? What outcomes do I worry about? Do I worry that my child will not have a good enough education in order to face the world and the profession that he or she may need to have in the future? Is that fear driving me to push too hard, you know, academically? Am I afraid that they're going to be unpopular? Is that fear pushing me too hard to make sure that she has all the right clothes, you know, and that he is able to get into all the best sports positions and so on? What's driving it? How do my reactions teach them what to fear? What fears am I passing on? And these are just things for us to kind of think about. I am really not afraid of mice and spiders and crawly things. There's just not so. I guess all those years in tents were really good for me, but I still fear conflict, and I still fear being insignificant. I'm afraid that maybe my life isn't going to be important, and so those fears have an impact on the way I relate to my children even today. So I need to kind of look at those. All right, we live in an age of fear. We live in an age of a collective cultural anxiety. Why is this? Every era of humanity, every century, every millennia, people have been fearful. I mean, you know, fear is just a part of who we are. But what is different? Is there something different about our sense of fear in the modern world? Any ideas about that? Yes.
I think part of it is that media provides images that make something that is really rare seem like it could happen to anybody.
Wow, that's a very good one. Yep. Our media is showing us all the possible things that could go wrong. You know, 100 years ago, we wouldn't even have known that it was possible to experience some of the devastating things that we see around images of us around all the time. Anything else? Yeah.
I think part of it is that we have so many comforts that we're not used to not experiencing comforts, whether
okay.
it's being in the woods or...
Yes, I think that's really very true. Part of it is that our modern life is so easy and we have become accustomed to so much comfort that the idea that we might not have something or have something that's or have to face difficulty or discomfort is frightening to us. Okay, so those are both very good answers. There's another one. Anything else you can guys can think of? What is unique about this age that we live in terms of a collective cultural anxiety, especially about parenting? Anything unique? Yes.
Pushing our kids to succeed, like in sports and things like that. There's you know, such a drive in parents to push
the competition
their kids.
Is amazing. You know, the competition to have your kid have a good resume by the time he's out of first grade is really significant. So that's part of it. We live in a world now where success in life is defined by a person's career. So that's part of it. Well, there's another thing. Yeah, way back there. Scream.
I think there's like a fear of being hurt or getting sick.
Right, our fears are totally out of proportion with reality. Yeah, we have the best medical care that mankind has ever had, and yet we have the most fear of illness and that kind of thing. Okay, there's another thing, and that what I want to bring out is that one of the reasons we have so much anxiety in our world today is that we have fewer resources. We have fewer resources. Yeah, we have insurance. Yeah, we have all those good schools and all those good doctors and all that. But we no longer have the relational network that families counted on for millennia. We no longer have the tribe and the clan and the family that have our back. And so if you have parents in town who help you with your kids and are involved, that's a marvelous thing. But most people today don't have that, or very many people today don't have that. And because we have fewer resources, parenting has become an isolated, very just me and my kid and me and my husband and my kid kind of an endeavor. And because we're in this alone, we have to make it work. Whereas in the past, we had so many more resources to depend upon. And so if I can just encourage one thing today, build that network, build those relationships so that we have more to fall back on. Okay, what does our fear look like? It manifests itself in obsessive focus on safety, about things and cars. We already mentioned playgrounds that have to have all the rounded edges and we can't even have sand anymore. For God's sake, because there's, you know, germs in the sandbox. Germs, all the surfaces have to be carefully disinfected, you know. You know all this stuff. You know, we get all hung up about safety, you know. Why is MetLife so effective in its advertising? Because it says insurance is for the if in life. You know, it's a great tagline. If this happens, if that happens, oh, I gotta have it. Obsessive need to protect. I need to protect our children from people. No one should upset my child. And also from no one should embarrass my child. No one should be better than my child. And we all have seen these things, and we don't need to go into them today. But this is what our fear looks like. Now, how does the emotional response affect fear? How does our emotional well-being, our emotional state affect our fear or affect perception of pain? Any ideas?
I think the more emotional you are, the worse you can make the fear.
Exactly. The more emotion is attached to whatever is going to happen, the more painful it's going to be, the more fearful it's going to be, and that kind of thing. So our emotion, and the emotion of fear goes together very, very tightly. The emotion, when there's a lot of emotion, we have an exaggerated perception of pain. I have an exaggerated perception of pain. My dentist gets really exasperated with me because I have to get like 5 injections of Novocaine. Now, maybe it's because I went to a dentist who didn't believe in giving Novocaine to children and I had my teeth drilled without Novocaine. I don't know what it's from. But I have an exaggerated perception of pain. Sometimes I even take Valium before I go to the dentist. You know, it's ridiculous. But because of that emotional component, I experience that particular kind of pain in a different way. low tolerance for discomfort. Sometimes we think, you know, a child is thirsty. How many times have you been driving down the road and your kid says, I'm thirsty. And you feel like, oh, you just have to pull off the road and pass through McDonald's. You just have to get, you, what? People have been thirsty for millennia, you know? And the 5 minutes that it will take to get from your house or wherever you are to your house, or the 15 minutes or God forbid, even 20 minutes that that child will have to be thirsty, really won't hurt him, you know? But if we teach our children that they have to immediately get something to drink when they say they're thirsty, they have to immediately get something to eat when they say they're hungry, they have to immediately have entertainment when they say they're bored, we teach them, oh, it's bad to be thirsty or hungry or bored. We can't let that happen. And we actually lower their stress threshold. What is a stress threshold? Anybody have some ideas? What's a stress threshold? Yes? Just scream. Yeah, how much stress am I used to? What does it take to get me to go over the edge? Okay, and what we want to do with our children is we want to constantly be increasing their stress threshold. And we can increase their stress threshold by reassuring them in the moment of their fear, in the moment of their being thirsty or hungry or whatever, it's okay, I'm hungry too, we'll be home in half an hour. It's okay, I'm thirsty too, it's okay, I'm nervous too, I'm kind of afraid too, this storm is bigger than I thought it was going to be, but we'll be okay, let's just sit together. And as we reassure them and as we force them to experience what it is that they're afraid of in a protective way, we help them to increase their stress threshold. And they realize that if they're hiking through the woods all day long and they forgot to bring their trail mix or whatever, they'll survive, and they'll go home and say, wow, I got to do this cool thing. In relationships, they have a stress threshold for relationships as well. When they come home and say, so-and-so said this to me, we can say, wow, that must have hurt. That's really a drag. But we don't help them plot their revenge. We don't, pull them out of Girl Scouts because that's a bad place to be. We don't, go and yell at their teacher and say, how could you dare embarrass my child in front of the class? We just say, it happens. That's really a bummer. I had that happen when I was a kid, too. And, it doesn't mean anything about who you are. Okay. Emotion and fear. If our child believes that the world is not a safe place, they will live with an underlying sense of anxiety. And we know that there are dangers in the world. But basically, I would guess that 99% of our children are going to make it to adulthood. It is a dangerous world in some ways, but it's not anywhere near as dangerous as we perceive it to be. And we need to be communicating to our child, life is an opportunity. Life is exciting. Life is a positive thing, not life is threatening. Because with a lot of emotion, our children will be more alert, more vigilant, and more easily offended or more easily affected by the things that happen. People, when there's a big emotional content behind the idea that the world is not safe, people will be overly reactive to other people and to circumstances. So how do we reduce the emotional climate that promotes fears in our children's lives? One of the things, of course, is dealing with our own fears and anxieties. Our kids know if we're scared to death to drop them off at daycare or, child care or whatever. They sense when we're afraid. Dealing with our own fears and anxieties is really a helpful thing. Explaining to the child what we will do today. Sometimes if you just get up in the morning and say, hey, we're going to go do this, then we're going to do that, and then we're going to do that. It helps them to know what's going to happen, and so they don't feel quite so afraid of, like, why are we getting in the car again? I don't think I was very good at that, because one of my children was consistently saying, you didn't tell me we were going to do this, and I probably didn't. So I've learned from that, and I think it's helpful to kind of explain to a child what the day is going to hold. Being positive about new experiences. Oh, we get to go do this new thing. Oh, this is cool. Let's do this together. Being positive about things as opposed to, oh, we're going to try this. I hope it's okay with you. Just the way we approach it. Having realistic expectations for behavior and not being stressed in your own relationship. Now, this is a kind of, may seem like an out of context thing, but when our children chronically misbehave, and we're chronically frustrated with them because we haven't set appropriate limits, and they and we have stress in our own relationship, they are also inclined to be more fearful as they approach people and as they approach other situations. So having our own relationship with our child be at a lower stress level is an important thing. And here's where consistent discipline and a consistent, I told you to do this, I expect you to do it, you get it done, instead of a child who's constantly whining, constantly trying to push the limits and get their own way, and we're giving in, and we're frustrated, and their behavior is getting worse, and we're getting more frustrated. Well, that child, if he lives within that emotional context, is going to have more fears than another child, because that basic connection with mom and dad is more stressed. Regular schedules and caregivers. Children need predictability. Now, here's where there's a paradox as well. The more predictable we are, the more we can do outside things. Like, for instance, if my kid knows that I usually get him up at this time and we have regular meal times and he's going to go to bed at 7 o'clock or 7:30 or whatever your bedtime is, and we do that on a regular basis, then when I say, hey, we're going to go to a party tonight, and I don't put him to bed until 11 o'clock or midnight or whatever, it doesn't freak him out because he knows that life in general is pretty predictable. And so new experiences or things that are totally out of the norm, they tend to have a much better stress tolerance for. But if every day is unpredictable, if bedtime is different every day, if routine is different every day, if we go to a different place every day, then the kid tends to be a lot more vigilant. So you'll find that your children are actually more flexible and easier to take to parties or take to do different kinds of things if they have a predictability in their life. All right, we also have to answer this question. This is a very, very significant question. What exactly is an emergency? Because if everything negative generates a strong response, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, then what will that teach our children? You know, if they come home from school and they're sad because somebody hit them, and we respond really strongly to that, or if they fall down and they skin their knee and we respond really strongly to that, What starts to happen here? Any ideas? They what? They start to think, oh no, this is bad. Oh, I skinned my knee. This must be really bad. This must be, you know, something to get upset about. You know, so we as parents need to set the tone and say and decide for them what is an emergency. You know, and if we are overreacting, you know, to things, our children will often learn to overreact as well. Yes?
I think also if we overreact so much all the time, they may not share with you something, because I've seen this.
Yes.
And then it's like a crying wolf type thing. So, like, they'll say, you know, they won't say anything to you.
Very good.
Maybe they need to bring up.
Yes, you're talking about the older child, and the older child has learned that if I tell mom that so-and-so was mean to me at school, she's going to freak out. Well, I'm just not going to tell her.
My 7-year-old.
Oh, 7-year-old. Okay.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If they think that telling their parents that they've had a problem at school means calling in the cavalry, and they're going to be embarrassed because the school's going to be involved, and the principal's going to be involved, and the teacher's going to be involved, well, then why would they come home and tell us what happens at school? They need to know that the things that happen at school are really pretty normal most of the time. You know, they are. And kids are mean, and that's just the way it is. And then we can talk about these kinds of things. But yes, so if everything that happens to them generates a strong emotional response by us, they will tend to believe us and be afraid. Oh, I can't go camping because the ground is hard. Or I can't go because there are mosquitoes. Or I can't go, you know, or I see people, even in my art studio, they come in and they go, oh, I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't do blood, you know, because they think they might get cut on the glass or something like that. I tell people, you know, when we start the class, okay, the Band-Aids are over there and blah, blah, blah. And every once in a while I have someone just, oh, I don't do blood. I'm not going to do this. And I'm like, really? You know, we say, you know, our kids say, oh, I've heard kids say, I don't do bugs, you know, or I don't do fill in the blank, you know. So if everything, they tend to believe us, or they tend to see through us and dismiss us. They say, oh, she's just, you know, she's just always upset about everything. It doesn't mean anything. And so then we have lost our voice for real emergencies. And this is one of the reasons why it was really important to me as a mother to never yell at my children. Now, I don't know what their perception of that was, but I don't think I really yelled at them very much. I very rarely raised my voice. I can be very intense without raising my voice, but just because I have that kind of personality. But I didn't yell at them unless there was an emergency. And they knew that if I said to them, get out of the car right now, that they needed to get out of the car right now. you know, or whatever. A good example of this would be my brother. He and his wife were at a park in another state that they were not familiar with one day, and their son, who was about 4 or 5 years old at the time, just went running up a hill. It was a beautiful day. He was running as hard as he could to the crest of a hill. But my brother at the bottom of the hill saw it from a completely different perspective, and he saw that there was a 30-foot drop right at the end, right at the crest of the hill onto a railroad track. And so this child was running, you know, towards this horrible cliff. So he screamed, "Tim, stop!" Really, really, really loud. And what did Tim do? He stopped. But why did he stop? Why did he stop? You see parents yelling at their kids all the time, and the kids just keep on going. Why did he stop? He heard the emotion and the urgency in his father's voice, and he wasn't used to hearing that. So he knew that there was something out of the ordinary, and he needed to stop right now. And he stopped like 3 feet from the edge of that cliff. So one of the reasons, one of the great reasons for not yelling at our children and not overreacting to things and not making things be big emergencies is the fact that they'll listen to us then when we do say, hey, this is really a big deal, this is really an emergency, then that we have their attention. But if we're constantly overreacting to things, they will pretty much learn to dismiss us, especially by the time they get to be a little bit older. They'll just be like, whatever, you know, that's what my mom says. So, okay, let's move ahead here. Maybe we'll move ahead here. There we go. So oftentimes parents function in the role of prophets. And I think this is just sort of what pet peeve thing of mine. I think we don't need to do this. You know, when they're climbing a tree, don't say, you'll fall, you know, or you'll get burned, or oh, you got to put your coat on, you'll get sick, you'll get whatever. Because when we keep prophesying that all these things are going to happen and then they don't happen, again, our kids learn to blow us off. This is my son who was probably 8, climbing a palm tree in the Amazon. And I think we need to just realize that if our child has not been to the emergency room at least 3 times by the time he's a teenager, he's really left out of some really significant life experiences. You know, I mean, really. You know, if they don't have stitches and if they don't have broken bones, I mean, what's childhood for? And yeah, they need that. So what about normal childhood fears? How do we comfort and deal with these? And I'm talking about the younger children here. Fears, things that go bump in the night, dogs that bark. I particularly am, to this day, still afraid of dogs. Strangers, new places, fear of losing their favorite things. You know, they've got that toy or that cuddly or that whatever, and they're afraid that they're going to lose it. Physical things. I know a child who was terrified of snow. So how do you help that child learn the joy of sliding down a hill on a wintry day? What are some ideas here? What do we do about normal, absolutely normal childhood fears that all the kids have that are not based on some malicious presence in their life? How do we deal with fear itself? What kind of ideas do you guys have? Yes.
Well, the one thing that comes to my mind is one of my girls is afraid of thunderstorms, mm-hmm. But I love them, and we will sit out on the front porch when one is coming through, and I'll have her sit with me, and so that then the thunder gets really loud, and I just try to reassure her, and I say, you know, thunder is really loud. I said, but it cannot hurt you. I was like, it's just loud.
Uh-huh. Awesome.
So I try to reassure her that way, and, you know, she sits on my lap. And so that's one thing I do to
Perfect.
Help with fear.
So what you're doing is you're telling her, I hear you. I understand that you're afraid of thunderstorms. I don't happen to be afraid of thunderstorms, so I'm a good resource for you. So you can sit with me, and I will give you reassurance. And for many, many, many of our children's young children's fears, this is the way we go about it. This is the natural thing that we do. We identify with them. We're present with them. We give them the reinsurance. We give them information. You gave your daughter information. Thunder can't hurt you. It's just sound. It sounds scary, and you can even feel it. The air just kind of shakes, you know, in the thunder. But you give them information that this thing cannot hurt you. Or this dog is on a leash, or whatever it is, or you are safe right now. And normalize the experience. Just say, oh my God, I can't believe you're afraid of storms. Really? What? you know. But to say, you know, lots of people are afraid of storms. It's okay, you know. Lots of people are afraid of dogs. Lots of people are afraid of things like that. You know, it's just one of those things, you know, and we don't always know why we're afraid of things, but it's okay. Sit here with me, and we'll talk about it, and we'll sit through the storm. So that's normalizing their experience. But I also want to encourage us all to stretch our children without overwhelming them. And you are stretching them by having her sit outside in a thunderstorm. But it's not overwhelming because you're there. But we need to help them move outside of their comfort zone. Okay, I'm terrified of dogs. But since this dog is behind a fence, my mom can help me move up to the fence and look at the dog. Now, I'm not going to put my fingers in there. But I can get close enough to the dog to see, you know, that it's just a dog. You know, and that it's behind a fence and it has an owner and all those different kinds of things. So stretching our kids without overwhelming them. This particular child that was afraid of snow, it was necessary to just kind of like put her down in the snow, you know, to stand there, you know, and see, okay, the feet don't get wet, feet don't get cold, it's okay. Then pick up, okay, then carry to the park, then carry up the hill, you know, scream all the way down the hill. And then, very, very interestingly, at the end of the last scream, can we do it again? You know? And so sometimes we have to carry our kids crying someplace and to kind of stretch them a little bit. As long as we're there and we're helping them through an experience that we know in the end is going to be a basically positive experience, we can help them to stretch and move out of their comfort zone. We need to also teach them to use their resources. And this is something that we also need to teach ourselves. But teaching them to use their resources is really important because we're not always going to be sitting on the porch with them. We're not going to follow them to school. We're not going to be with them all the time. So we need to teach them when they're afraid of things that they can go to parents, to family, to teachers. I think one of the coolest things about our church here at Xenos is that other adults besides us are involved in positive ways in the lives of our children. My kids benefited enormously from cell group, from Oasis, from other adults besides mom and dad having a positive role in their life. And we need to be able to teach our kids that there are other resources. Also, looking at their experience or the experience of their friends, you know, kind of helping them sit down and say, okay, now here's what's happening to you. Do any of your friends have the same kinds of problems? Oh, really? They have the same problems. Well, how are they dealing with it? What resources do they have? What do you learn from the fact that there are other people around you who are having similar kinds of experiences? And we need to help them understand that God is a real resource. God is not something that we tack on to our life at the end of the day, or something that we do on Sundays, or something that the last resource, we'll pray about it. You know, if all else fails, maybe we'll pray about it. But God and our relationship with God is a strong foundation and a rock of our life. And it makes a difference that we have that relationship with Him. And so when we teach them to use their resources, one of the most significant resources that they will ever have in their entire life, the most significant resource, is a God who is unchanging and always on their side, always ready to come and to comfort them. And so we need to teach them that theologically, you know, by telling them about it, teaching them about God, but also experientially, living it that way ourselves. And say, yeah, I'm a little bit afraid about this thing in my job. I'm a little bit afraid about this or that. But I'm praying about it, and I'm seeing how God is helping me to move through it. You know, we need to let them know that God is a real resource and not just something that we talk about or read stories about, and show them from our own lives how we rely on God. You know, during that thunderstorm, it's a marvelous thing to be able to say, I am so grateful for the house that we have. Look how sheltered we are. You know, let's be thankful, you know, that God has given us this wonderful house that we live in. There are just thousands and thousands of ways throughout our children's lives that we can reinforce the idea that God is real. And He's there, and He makes a difference. And we are not cast alone in this universe. One of the biggest causes of the angst of our society is that we believe as a society that we are cast alone in the universe, that we're on this rock. What is it? Third rock from the sun? Fourth rock from the sun? There's a TV show even about the fact that we're just out there spinning around the sun by ourselves. And it's not true. There is a real God who makes a real difference. And I can say, growing up as an extremely fearful child, I was 20 years old before I could look somebody in the eye and talk to him at the same time. I can say that my God has made a huge difference in who I am and the kinds of things that I take on in my life and the way I deal with life. And without my God, I would definitely not be here today. And I don't think I would have gotten married, and I don't think I would have had children. I don't think I would have moved out of that fearful, isolated way of living that I had as a preteen and teenager. God is a real resource and not just something to tack on to the list of things that we can do for our kids. What about persistent fears? You know, what about those fears, you know, your child's getting up, you know, night after night with nightmares, or they won't go to school, you know, because they're, you know, things that are more, a little bit more than just the dog is barking, okay? I think the first thing when our children have persistent fears and things that are really bothering them and things that are not going to be settled by a little bit of reassurance and all that is we need to say, to ask ourselves, does this fear reflect on me? How does this fear affect me? Now, that sounds kind of selfish. I mean, really, they're the one who are afraid. Why am I asking myself, does this fear reflect on me? Why would I want to ask that question? Why would that be relevant? Any ideas? Yes. Quite possibly we may be contributing to their fear. Okay. Yeah, because of the way we respond to it. Or perhaps we are in great conflict with their other parent. Or there are, you know, really life circumstantially very difficult things going on. So that's part of it. What else? Anything else?
It seems like if you had an understanding of this is like kind of my underlying understanding of myself in the situation, you can just not react out of that.
Yes.
You might be able to manage some of like, oh, I need to help them with their fear instead of, if I understand how it's affecting me, then I can make sure to make it not all about me.
Exactly. When we understand how their fears affect us, when we understand that we feel like a failure as a parent because our child is waking up screaming every night, when we understand that it's not about us, when we understand that we are the ones who are the resource, then we can kind of chill out a little bit and just say, okay, these things happen, these fears happen, you know, and we can be an advocate for our child instead of being all caught up with the fear that they have. Does that make sense? We need objectivity. We need to be able to take a step back and say, this is not about me. Now, maybe I am contributing to it because I'm screaming at my husband at night and they hear me, and then I need to really deal with those ways that I'm contributing to this. Or maybe their fears are exaggerated because someone in my family is dying and there's nothing I can do about that. But so I need to talk that through with my child. But the bottom line is that their fear is not about me, and I need to be able to take a step back from that and not be so emotionally involved in it that I can't respond to them in a way that's helpful. Okay, so then we want to ask, well, when does this happen? You know, is it at night? Is it at the daytime? Is it with certain situations? Why is my child getting into, you know, a constant, like a hysterical crying kind of thing? What is it about? What can he or she, what can they tell me about their experience? And let that child kind of think it through, too. Why is it upsetting to me? We had an example when we lived, there was a time when we were living about 1,000 miles up the Amazon, and in order to work in a certain location, we had to go 2 days by boat into the jungle to work in this little worker training center and to do medical clinics. And one of our children, totally out of the blue, started having just hysterical breakdowns every day, afraid of the water, afraid of rain. We're in a tropical rainforest. Afraid of snakes, afraid of bugs. And at some point, every day for like a week and a half, there was a hysterical fear, just overwhelming fear episode. And we were clueless. We were like, well, when did this start? I mean, it just started, it seemed like it started out of the blue. And we were so concerned about it. We were considering, okay, we're going to go back to town. You know, we can't let this go on. It's going on long enough that this is not healthy. So, but then we started thinking, well, you know, the other sibling has fears and has been sick and, you know, just actually, you know, got hurt the other day. And we seem to be able to comfort that one. Why can't we comfort this one? And it dawned on me as I was just kind of thinking through this and praying through this that the younger child had not had a personal relationship with Jesus. You know, she'd heard all the Bible stories and all that kind of stuff. The older child had prayed to Jesus to come into his life and had the power of the Holy Spirit in his life. And so when we would say, okay, yeah, this is scary, but here's how it is, and God's taking care of us, he'd say, oh, yeah, that's right, cool, you know? And so with the other child, I encouraged my husband to take the child and to explain the gospel, explain who it is that's in charge of the universe, who it is that created this rainforest, and how that child can enter into a relationship with that creator. And she did, and made a faith commitment to an understanding of the reality of God. And from that day on, there was never another episode of hysterical crying. It made a real difference because we have a real God, and he can and does act in our hearts. And it's exciting to see, you know, when our children are afraid and when they have a breakthrough. And it may be in high school about relationships, and it may be in junior high school about fear of failure. But when we have a spiritual breakthrough with our children and they see the reality of God's comfort and of his ability to hold them and care for them, it's a wonderful thing, and a thing that most likely they will never forget, you know. And so that questioning, you know, what's wrong here, what's wrong here, what's wrong here, needs to include a spiritual dimension as well, because many times there is a spiritual dimension. And then also sometimes we just need to, you know, we've done everything we can think of, we just need to look for other help. Ask the pediatrician, maybe that's pretty normal, maybe he sees a lot of cases of the same thing in that kid's age. You know, ask people who are, we're in our church, ask people who we think of as being, you know, responsible resources for us. So sometimes persistent or more upsetting fears, they happen. But we got to kind of step aside, step out of it, and be the one who is the resource for our child, rather than getting caught up in it and getting just as upset as they are. Fear relates to life perspective. How long do I have? 10:30? Oh, it's 10 till 11. I'm sorry. I'm a yakker. Okay, I'll get through this. Fear relates to our life perspective, and as we train our child, as we walk with them, as we talk with them, it's important for us to realize that they either are developing a mindset that I need to protect myself, or they're able to open their horizons and see there is life beyond and purpose beyond myself. So they're either developing the mindset that life is threatening or that life is an opportunity. And so we need to kind of help them move towards the healthy life as an opportunity. A couple of myths. One of them is, to be a good parent, I have to eliminate struggles or discomfort for my child. And I hope that we've shown today that that's just not true, that struggles and discomfort are an essential part of building up the muscles of being a strong person and being a courageous person. Another myth to be a good parent is that I can't make mistakes because I could totally ruin my kid if I screw up. Well, I thought I was a pretty good parent for quite a number of years. And the farther I get away from that experience, the more I'm able to look back and say, well, I would really have done that differently, and I wish I had been a little bit more like this here. And you know what? Nobody is going to escape that. No matter how much we want to be a good parent, no matter how deeply invested we are in wanting to be a good parent, nobody will get to be my age and be able to look back and say, I did everything right. It just can't happen. So we need to just kind of like take that off the shelf, that expectation that I'm going to ruin my child. Because really, you know what? There's several people involved in this process. There's me as the parent, and I do have a role to guide and to encourage my child. But there's the child himself who is going to either incorporate or not the messages and the understanding of God at work in their lives. And there's God himself. And so it's really not up to us. We can't control the outcome. We have to let go of that need to control the outcome with our children. Helen Keller once said that character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experiences of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved. And of course, we all know that Helen Keller was a deaf and blind person who lived through tremendous adversity. She also said, avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. The fearful are caught just as often as the bold. It's a very interesting thought. You know, anyway, I think we will kind of rest with that. I do want to just make a little plug for the Daniel and the Lion's Den approach. Sometimes we think we can just sit our kids on our lap and read all the Bible stories about courage, and that will and it will take. And I'm telling you, it won't. They need to be exposed to real controlled dangers, real controlled fears, and taught through life experience, because we can't just tell them about growing up and being courageous. So opportunities to be challenged. What are my child's daily weekly activities? How can I bring a challenge into their life? How big is their comfort zone? Is there a way to make it bigger? Are they ever required to leave the zone? And what happens if they do? If they are outside of their comfort zone, how do they react? How can I help them through those reactions? Well, the very last thing here is, my husband brought this up yesterday because we were talking about fear. And he said that he'd been reading a book, and it had mentioned that the highest praise for a soldier in battle was a certain characteristic. And I immediately jumped at the wrong answer. But what do you think the highest praise for a person under that kind of stress would be? That they are? That was what I said, courageous. I thought, yeah, courage, that's the most important thing. He said, no, actually, the most important thing for someone under that kind of stress is presence of mind. And how do we get presence of mind? But by being calm, because we're able to see that we can handle the circumstance that we're in, you know, and that we do have resources. All right, I talked too long. Questions and answers, and questions anyway, I don't know about answers.
Do you have any suggestions for stubbornness? Because my children tend to be stubborn at times, and they just say, I will absolutely not try that.
How old are they?
I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, but the 13-year-old especially, it's went back to maybe 8 years old.
And because of a fear? The child is stubborn because of a fear?
I don't really know. It could be a fear. It could be just unwilling to try new things.
Yeah, well, I think if a child is unwilling to try new things, then we need to sit down with them and identify that as an issue. You know, honey, it's hard to try new things, and I get that, you know, but new things are a really important part of life. So let's agree together on something new that we can do together, you know, and then agree on that and make a date and then go do something different. And as that kind of thing helps to stretch a child, I think that some of that can be overcome, but I would say that it would be important for the parent not to give in to that, just say, oh, okay, you know, but to find ways to do new stretching experiences. Yes?
My son is fearful of speaking to adults,
mm-hmm.
And I know can that be a more developmental thing that he'll just outgrow, or how do I encourage him without being too overly...
I think that's pretty normal, you know, for a 7-year-old to be afraid of talking to adults, but it does tend to indicate that he's not around a lot of adults. And so I would want to know, in my home fellowship, are the kids included, or is it just the adults here and the kids over there? I would want to integrate the age ranges, as much as possible in my child's social life, so that they're used to being around adults other than myself. That would be a big part of it. And then just to encourage him to, you say you're at a party or someone's at your house, would you take this plate over to so-and-so? Or would you take this over to, you know, whatever. Ways in which he would have to engage, even if he doesn't have to say a whole lot, at least he's engaging with adults in a way that's pretty non-threatening. Anything else? Yes, in the back.
I have an 8-year-old son who is still like afraid to go upstairs or down to the basement by himself, things like that, because of the boogeyman or strangers in the house.
I was terrified of the basement until I was a teenager.
I had nightmares. But how do I help him through that? And you know, 8's a little still old, or will he outgrow it? Or
yeah, I think one of the first things that sometimes when kids have irrational fears, it's annoying. You know, it's annoying. Sometimes it's embarrassing if they have these irrational fears in front of other people. So my first thing would be just to say, it's no big deal. When he's 20, he probably will be okay to go upstairs and downstairs. So I'm like taking the pressure off here. It doesn't mean that this is going to be a lifelong problem. So I would say, hey, honey, we need to get something from the basement. Let's go together. you know, and just go together and turn on the lights and just say, hey, here's the basement, you know, and here's what's here and let's get what we're doing and just do that a number of times, you know, and maybe he'll still be afraid of the basement for a while, but I would not make it be a big issue.